The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining this week is New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, one of my favorite people in the world. I mean that. Welcome back, Tom.
Alan, thank you. Back at you, and it's great to start the new year with you on your show. Look forward to doing it many times in 2020.
So here's the big question. I bet you knew it was coming. How much is New York in debt?
Well, the real question is the budget gap has grown, $6 billion gap, and that's really what we're going to have to face in the upcoming budget cycle, much of that having to do with unexpected spending increases in Medicaid that weren't fully anticipated.
And why not?
Well, if you look at the trend, because there was some discussion of deferring the payment, rightfully so, a concern and discussion. In the earliest year, that wasn't the first time that happened. What has been happening is that gap has been growing, and something we identified in our budget report in July. But Medicaid is driven by those that use the program, and there have been also some increases added on, trying to increase the reimbursement to providers because many of them operate at a very thin margin, and increase for wages for low-paid workers. So all that has a cumulative effect in addition to the utilization. And at the federal level, you're starting to see some diminution of the federal reimbursement that we've gotten. Uh-huh. So it's really a combination of factors. Perhaps you could argue that DOB should have been a little more forthcoming sooner with some of the information. But either way, it certainly hadn't been projected. I think that's fair to say. And I think that's going to drive, the big issue in terms of the budget. In terms of the overall debt burden, as we know, we are coming up very close to our statutory debt cap. And, one of the big concerns that I have as they get into the budget negotiation is that you really have to either control spending, and that could mean spending cuts,
or
raise revenue.
Raise taxes.
And number three is borrowing, and that's the piece that I do hope is totally avoided. We already are a very highly indebted state. We actually have been recommending the opposite. Some questioned, whether the timing makes it realistic, and that was to say we need to build up our rainy day reserves, which New York has not done a good job of, although we've had some improvement this year. Because, Alan, we're talking about issues of spending and balancing the budget. But what we're not prepared for is that eventual economic downturn that may happen. And many other states are better positioned for that by building up the reserves. So that's another discussion, but one that I hope is incorporated into the conversation. Now, of course, beginning the new year, the Division of Budget did announce that there could be across-the-board cuts in Medicaid of about 1%, basically starting in January, that will continue through the end of this fiscal year and roll over to next year.
So let me stop you. Wait.
Yeah.
So let's assume you cut the Medicaid reimbursement. Yeah. I know that the governor has said 1%, something like that. Then what do you do? I mean, isn't that money paying for health care for poorer and older people right now? How do you make that up?
Well, it's going to have an impact on the providers. They're going to have to look for, for opportunities to save. So it's two issues. It's certainly the consumers. It's the patients, those receiving the health care. But it's the providers as well. So you're talking about the hospitals, many of which, are really operating on a very thin margin. some of our hospitals, their prime way of being funded is through Medicaid dollars, Medicare dollars. You know, you have some with a hospital mix where they don't have a lot of private pay customers, private insurance customers. It's going to be a challenge. 1% may not sound like a lot, you know, to begin with, but for some of the providers, it's going to be a real challenge.
Are some of those providers, as you put them, taking advantage, is a relative minus
well,
to say?
You know, one of the other parts of this discussion has to be, are we being as efficient as we can be with spending Medicaid dollars? Part of that question is, are we rooting out abuse, fraud? And the other part is efficiency or lack thereof. You know, we've done audits, as you know, we talked about it on your show, on a regular basis of the Medicaid program. We have a dedicated audit team that always looks at that. And just looking at the past, 3 or 4 years of our audits, if you accumulate what we found in terms of waste, inefficiency, in some cases fraud, missed opportunities to realize revenue, for instance, maximizing the rebates that we'd be entitled to, we're talking about $3 billion right there. So I'm hoping that part of what the challenge will be is not only to look at the spending side, but also to say and come to the controller's office and look for what we've pointed out. How is it that we can make the system work better, more efficiently, save money without impacting on providers, without impacting on people that are getting the services?
Well, Tom DiNapoli, when you tell them what to do, that's your job as the controller, and they don't do it, that's infuriating, isn't it?
Well, it's infuriating, but, you know, one of the challenges of our work is that we don't have any enforcement power. You know, people ask me all the time, so you do these audits, can't you make them comply with your recommendations? The answer is no. I mean, I do have to say that in many cases, Department of Health has changed or recouped some of the money. Not in all cases, but, you know, all we could do is point it out. And unfortunately, when we go back in, we still find some of the same issues that recur. People, you know, being double billed, as I mentioned, the rebates not being fully realized. Some of the problems in transitioning from fee-for-service to Medicaid managed care. So, you know, it hasn't been a
total
perfect
loss
system, and we'll continue to do those audits, and we hope that this will be part of having us deal with the gap without hurting people.
Okay, let's move this over a little bit. You have a Democratic governor, Andrew Cuomo, a guy who was always sort of seen as middle to conservative Democrat. Along comes primaries. He goes left, no question about it, in my mind. You get a Democratic assembly, and then you get a Democratic Senate, something his father didn't have. His father, Mario, had a Republican Senate, and I think it's fair to say it suited him just fine, despite protestations to the opposite, because the Republican Senate was a break on spending, something Andrew Cuomo now has to do himself. And how can he be a liberal Democrat if he's breaking on spending? Don't you see what I'm saying here?
Well, look, at the end of the day, the numbers still have to add up. And while you're right, there was a big political shift based on the elections in 2018. Those folks, particularly in the Senate, a lot of new members, they're up for their first reelection. And as one who ran many times to the legislature, I can tell you that first reelection is in many ways the toughest race, sometimes even tougher than your first race. So, you know, they're going to have to account for the budget. They're going to have to account for what will be the impact on taxpayers. There are other issues that people are starting to redebate a bit, you know, criminal justice reform. You know, you're seeing a lot of discussion about that right now. So I think that for many of the newer members, particularly in the Senate, you know, they're going to be looking very carefully at what's being proposed and what will they be able to go back to their constituents with and say that they've acted responsibly for the state of New York. So that may not be a partisan Republican-Democrat issue, although you're starting to see already some of the Republican rhetoric, you know, trying to look for opportunities. But, you know, it's going to be an interesting year. Look at the number of retirements that have been announced already among Republican senators. So this notion that, you know, some of these new Democrats are vulnerable, you know what? You haven't asked me for 2020 predictions yet, but I think there's an excellent chance you're going to see an even bigger Democratic majority in the state Senate than you have right now.
So let me ask you this, and it becomes very important. Does Cuomo, who says he's going to run for a fourth term, have a problem now that he has a Democratic Senate and a liberal Democratic Senate who's passing liberal Democratic bills? Does he have a problem?
Well, look, at the end of the day, even liberals, you know, have to have the budget add up. You know, arithmetic is arithmetic. So the budget has to be a balance. I think the difference is, you know, with a Democratic Senate is that in terms of priorities, issues like education, issues like health care, you know, are going to be very, very key. So I think in terms of overall, you know, priorities in terms of policy areas, I think the governor and the legislature will largely be on the same page. It's going to be getting into the details of the specifics of which programs, and on something like education, how does the formula play out in terms of the different districts and different communities that are represented? And that's where you'll probably have some, you know, perhaps some initial disagreement. Okay. But at the end of the day, they need to get the budget done on time. It would be terrible if we go back to the bad old days of late budgets. And the numbers have to add up. And you know, that's going to be their job. They'll get it done, whether it's liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican. That's still the task. And you know, I think you've got smart leadership in Speaker Hastie and in Leader Stuart Cousins, and I think they've figured out how to work together with the governor in 2019. I think the same will happen in 2020. And the legislature's running again. It's in their interest to get it all done and have it add up.
So let's remember, when you say Stuart Cousins, that is her last name. However, it's Andrea Stuart Cousins, because
yes.
I don't want anybody running around here thinking that there's a guy named Stuart Cousins out there. Okay, now, we are losing a congressperson this year because people are getting, you know, on the train or on the plane and going down to Florida and going away. Even the president did that. So what do you make of that?
Well, you know, look, I hope the worst is that we only lose one seat. You know, first of all, it reinforces the notion that everybody must be counted in the census. And you've had a tremendous grassroots effort from many organizations and stakeholders that are really getting out the word there. You must be counted. And there's a real concern, particularly in some of our communities where you have a high percentage of immigrants, with concern about the federal government and how immigrants are being treated, that people may be afraid to be counted. So that's a big issue right there. So it's representation, it's money. You know, federal formulas are tied to the calculation of the census, so everybody must be counted. And look, this is a trend. It's not new. It's unfortunate, but you know, in that latest report that we saw come out, you know, New York was certainly, out of the 10 states that lost population, one of the big losers, and that's, you know, that's a concern for all of us. I think people leave for different reason. Thankfully, we are a very, very welcoming state, so the influx of new Americans and immigrants helps counterbalance some of that. But Alan, it's a concern. It hurts us politically. It hurts us in terms of funding. There's no doubt about it.
And what happens? I mean, when this all comes down, what kind of problem are we in if we raise taxes again? Look, you're going to have to find out, as you said, $6 billion. You're going to have to come up with $6 billion. That's a lot of money. And how do you do that?
Do you
raise taxes? Because there's been some talk about revenue enhancement. That'll just make the exit door look more attractive.
It could. You know, people also choose to live in New York because of services. So that, I think that's always the balance. What is the tax burden that people can afford, and what are the services that they expect? And you know, I think it does get back to making sure, and, you know, this is something liberal Democrats have to believe in as well, that the money that we have, that we're not wasting, and that it's being spent wisely. And you know, that's certainly where our office comes into play. We talked about Medicaid, but there are many other programs where we found opportunities to be more efficient, to be wiser about how we're spending money. But, you know, it's a balancing act. That's what the legislature and the governor have to consider. At the end of the day, though, the numbers have to add up. You know, my job is to call out, you know, the numbers. We don't make the policy choices as where to put the money. But people want quality schools. They want quality health care. You know, transportation, especially downstate, you know, all this focus on the MTA, I mean, that's taking big dollars to deal with that. So, you know, you have to provide the services as well. That's, you know, part of why, you know, New Yorkers have concerns sometimes if they feel the subways aren't working. From a downstate perspective, the homeless issue, which is an issue – all across our state. People tell me, I went to New York City and all. Well, all you got to do is come out of my office on State Street in Albany, and there are more people today that are on the street, looking for money, and Lord knows where they may be sleeping. So this is a statewide issue as well. So you have to be smart with how you're spending the money and recognize that there are other quality of life issues that impact if you don't provide the services that could cause people to say, I don't want to be here anymore.
Tom, there are many things I want to ask you about. How's the pension fund and the pension fund investments doing?
Very well. I'm very pleased to say that we're benefiting from, obviously, the market. This December of 2019 ended very strong, very different than a year before in December 2018 when there was a significant loss, and it took us a while to earn the money back. So, keep in mind, Alan, we still have another quarter. This first quarter of the calendar year of 2020 is the last quarter of our fiscal year. So we won't have the number, for our audited return until the end of March. But certainly, we've got three good quarters under our belt. It looks like we're going to have a strong positive return. Our long-term goal is 6.8%. We're on track right now to beat and exceed that. So, but talk to me at the end of March. Then we'll know better where we're at. But, we're 96% funded, the fourth best funded state pension plan in the country. There's nothing going on right now that's going to change that. If anything, I'm looking forward to us being even stronger.
Okay, now, this, Tom DiNapoli, the stock market is doing very well, as you just said. It seems that it keeps on going. Maybe a major correction at some point. People are talking about that. Are you anticipating this?
Well, one of the reasons why we lowered our assumed rate of return is that we are assuming there'll be a lower return environment. I'm certainly not anticipating the kind of meltdown we had 10, 11 years ago.
Sure.
But, every year that about this time of year that the projections are that the market's going to go the other way, it hasn't happened. So, nobody has a crystal ball. I'm not anticipating 2020 to be a year of any significant correction. But the challenge we have, Alan, is that this bull market has gone on longer and stronger than any in history. At some point, the cycle will go in the other direction. So we've tried to be a bit more conservative with not only our assumed rate of return, but our investment strategy. We do not depend solely on the stock market. We certainly continue to have other kinds of investments in fixed income and alternatives to make sure we're not overextended in terms of the stock market. So we try to be diversified, and I think that's positioned us well and will continue to position us well.
Well, look, you've been a great controller. I'm your biggest fan. However, I do want to ask you something. It's just a simple little question.
Yeah.
For all those people who have money in the market or in their 401ks, should they take it out now or should they just leave it in?
Well, I am not a financial advisor.
Well, but you're smart. You're very smart.
Well,
you have all this responsibility, you've brought us through this thing with all this money in your stock holdings and the rest of it. So, if not you, who?
I would say this: people should have confidence. Have confidence that generally speaking, the U.S. economy not only is strong in its own right relative to the other economies globally, and we are a global economy now, we are the best and the strongest. So I would say have confidence. It's the start of a new year, a time where people look at their financial holdings and consider transactions. My personal point of view is always don't make any rash decisions or extreme decisions. There's no reason for that. I've been holding steady with how I'm handling my personal finances, and it's with a sense of confidence. So, again, I'm not qualified to give more specific guidance than that, but I think people can stay invested with confidence as we head into 2020.
So let me go to this idea that New Yorkers are paying a great deal of money for their housing. Incredible amounts. Nearly 1.4 million households paid half or more of their income in 2017 towards housing costs. Is that going to continue to happen? I mean, New York City is easy to see, but upstate New York, why there?
Yeah. Now, the issue of housing affordability is not a New York City only issue, and I'm glad you raised that. It's home ownership, and of course, increasingly people are renting rather than owning, and we see a similar percentage increasing of, you know, usually you use the guidepost of 30% of your household income. If more than that's going to housing costs, then you're hitting a level of unaffordability, and those percentages have been increasing. Look, I mean, that's, you know, New York, besides being a high cost state, there's an issue of supply in many communities, particularly for rental housing, and you know, it's one that I think every community struggles with, especially for young people that want to stay in an area that can't afford the housing. We want to keep them. We don't want them moving out of state for a job opportunity, and that's certainly been a dynamic that we've seen in many parts of the state. Certainly on Long Island, where I live, that's been one of the big issues. And there just hasn't been an adequate supply of affordable housing being created, either by government or by the private sector. So No simple solution on it, but it's one that we have to stay focused on.
Now, when we read Tom DiNapoli about your work, a good deal of the work of your auditors has been looking at our schools. Are schools being run efficiently? Are there crooks there that you're finding? I mean, give us a report.
Well, I have to say, in terms of, compared to some of the other audits that we uncover, somebody outright stealing, you don't see as much of that in as one might expect, thankfully, in terms of school districts. You know, a big part of why we've stepped up our audit work there, you know, since I began as controller, came out of that situation in Roslyn on Long Island. It was part of my old assembly district where, you know, the superintendent and top administrators, you know, stole like $11 million. So we don't see that. But what we do see, you know, our opportunities certainly to be more efficient. A lot of it just begins with our public schools, overestimating expenses and underestimating revenues, and then having big reserves and at the same time still raising taxes. So
is that bad?
Yeah, you know, there's got to be a sweet spot where you balance the need to be prepared if, let's say, there isn't as much state aid that comes down. But, you know, some of the districts, unfortunately, just stranded money in reserves or in a fund balance that exceeds the statutory limit that's allowed. And that's not smart budgeting. But, you know, we're looking at other issues as well, maybe less directly dollar and cents, but very important in our schools. You know, the issue of violence in our schools, you know, these terrible school shootings that we've seen across the country. We've been doing a lot of audit work, we actually had a roundtable discussion that was facilitated by SUNY Albany with stakeholders from all across New York to talk about how our schools complying with the laws that we have on the books right now to require emergency preparedness. How are we incorporating into that the challenge if there is an active shooter showing up at a school campus? Are our schools as prepared as they should be with emergency plans and coordination with first responders? So we're also looking at other issues related to education that really speak to the kind of safe and secure school environment that we want to see for all of our school children and school staff.
I know one of the things that I'm fascinated with is you've been warning us about reading the fine print on our new gift cards. What's the reason for that?
Well, I hope you got some good gift cards this past holiday season.
I get nothing. I get nothing from anybody.
No, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. But, you know, more and more people are using gift cards and as a way to, you know, do something nice for someone they care about. And we say read the fine print because although there are certain protections statutorily, some gift cards carry with them either an expiration date activity fees after a certain period of time. But the big message that we really wanted to get out is that when you get a gift card from a retailer and it's got a registration number on it, go to the website or however you do it and register that gift card formally, because if it gets lost or, you know, you don't use it after a period of time, that money is turned over, you know, by the business, by the retailer, to us in the controller's office as part of our unclaimed funds. So last year we got about $13 million in unclaimed funds from gift cards. And if you don't have that gift card registered, then we can't track it back and reimburse you for it. Now, if it's one of those cash, you know, gift cards or gift certificates you get at a restaurant, that's different. You know, that's something that's not going to be, you're not going to be able to register that. But for many of the gift cards that people get, they can register it. Please do that. And we recommend use the gift card within a year or so of when you've gotten it. That way you could be sure that it won't expire and it won't generate any activity fees that will reduce the value. So all that starts with reading the fine print and using that gift card as soon as you can.
I want to ask you about anti-Semitism, obviously. It's very important to many people who are Jewish, as I am. Tom DiNapoli, I know you've been close to the Jewish community. This is something that bothers you a great deal.
Yeah.
What are we going to do about this?
It is so distressing that in 2020 now, and closing on 2019, we've seen an escalation of incidents in New York. I mean, it's one thing when we hear about these terrible incidents in Europe, and even in our own country, you know, the Temple shootings in Pittsburgh and in California. This is New York. You know, we are based on tolerance. We've had a strong Jewish community all across the state for 100 and some odd years. And we have strong laws, you know, one of the first states to have hate crime laws and a lot of work in the schools and so on. And yet we see this rash of incidents. So I think it means we have to step up the law enforcement work, and you're seeing that happen at the state and the city level, certainly in New York City. We have to understand that we need to do more with our young people so that they are sensitized to what diversity really means and acceptance. This is something has to be dealt with. And, you know, at the end of the day, I ask why. In New York, why? It makes no sense. It's very, very disheartening.
Tom DiNapoli, thank you so much for that. We are out of time. Our guest has been New York State Comptroller, my friend Tom DiNapoli. Thanks so much for joining us, Tom.
Thank you, Alan. Happy New Year. Happy 2020.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.